Chapter 7. The Making of a Monster. The drug companies dodged a cannonball in 1962. Despite the damning evidence presented over the course of 2 years of Senate hearings, followed by a high-drama thalidomide scandal that confirmed Kefauver's lowest and most unforgiving estimation of post-ethical pharmaceuticals, the new law did not leave so much as a scratch on the industry's core business model. In ways that Kefauver did not foresee, new FDA standards actually increased the power of the industry's worst actors by forcing smaller firms out of business. As Merck CEO John Connor told an audience of conservative doctors shortly after the law's passage, many of the reforms had long been advanced by the biggest companies. In many ways, concludes historian Dominic Tubble, the pharmaceutical industry gained more than it lost. On the determining matters of patents and pricing, it lost nothing at all. This does not mean the industry was happy with the law. It was rattled by the FDA's new oversight powers, and it bristled at the new safety requirements attached to drug approval, even if they did raise the cost of market entry for generic competition. Previously, the industry had been bound only to the minimal labeling and safety requirements mandated by the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act and its sequel, the 1938 Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Now it had a satisfied trial criteria overseen by newly hired divisions of federal scientists and bureaucrats. The companies were also troubled by the impact of the extended public vivisection that Kefauver performed on the industry, revealing a system in which profits were eerily unconnected to normal price factors like production costs, supply, and demand. The hearings had failed to curtail drug patents, but they had shown the country things that couldn't be unseen and wouldn't be soon forgotten. The industry responded in the early 1960s by deepening strategic alliances with two communities with their own concerns about government regulation. One was the world of academic research, in particular, younger scientists who lacked memory of the old rules and were seen as more alert to the growing opportunities for commercial reward. The second and more important alliance was with the House of Medicine. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, the drug companies had been allied with orthodox medicine in opposing the many faces of unscientific and unprofessional greed, patents, trademarks, marketing, secrecy, and deceit. During the 1930s and 40s, organized medicine and the drug companies reunited in struggle against government health care and helped each other negotiate the identity crises brought about by the rise of ethical patenting and industry-academic partnerships. In the 1960s, they would walk as allies in defense of the very things they once defined themselves against, two of the most dexterous and fearsome agents of reaction in post-war America. Even during its ethical golden age, organized medicine evinced signs of moderate schizophrenia. In its view of science, knowledge, and medicine, it was proudly communistic. But when it came to health care, the administration of medicine, it was fiercely capitalistic and antisocial. When national insurance emerged as a progressive cause in the early 20th century, the AMA opposed calls by reformers to, in the words of Edward Devine, devote the fruits of abundance to the health of all. This opposition surfaced something deep-rooted in the profession. Sociologist of medicine Robert K. Merton gently referred to this as medicine's ambiguous situation, in which the socialization of medical practice is rejected in circles where the socialization of knowledge goes unchallenged. From the earliest days of their profession, physicians had organized their practices in the individualistic, fee-for-service, free enterprise pattern, writes historian Monty Poon. They had always been businessmen as well as public servants. This ambiguity was clarified during the AMA's mid-century partnership with the drug industry in the process of resolving its own contradictions. With the exception of two state chapters, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, the AMA stood unified against social reform before World War I. It removed all dissenters from state leadership positions and continued its opposition with one voice after the war, opposing the creation of private group insurance pools as well as public health initiatives and programs. During the 1920s, the AMA successfully lobbied to overturn a 1921 law that funded the creation of the nation's first women's health clinics. The doctors believed that the centers, which focused on prenatal and children's health, were an unacceptable intrusion onto its turf. Following a sustained AMA pressure campaign, Congress closed the clinics in 1927. When the Depression hit, the AMA expanded its political operation. It continued to reject any form of collective health care and correctly anticipated that the Democrats would push for government insurance as a crisis measure. In its attacks on the early New Deal, the AMA updated the red-baiting strategy that it deployed during the Red Scare that followed the Russian Revolution of 1917. The hysterical tone of Red Panic, the opposite of the calm and reassuring physician, marked the AMA's response to a 1932 report by an independent group called the Committee on the Costs of Medical Care. In a journal editorial presumably written by Morris Fishbein, the AMA did not merely state its disagreement with the committee's endorsement of private insurance pools, it denounced the report as incitement to revolution. The newly elected Democratic president noted the tone of the backlash with care. The doctor's extreme reaction, writes Paul Starr in The Social Transformation of American Medicine, confirmed the suspicions of many that it was risky even to advocate voluntary health insurance. Coming just as Franklin D. Roosevelt took office, the controversy over the report helped persuade the new administration that health insurance was an issue to be avoided. Just as the NAM Patents Committee's policy during the Bush-Kilgore debate went against the interests of the majority of NAM members, the AMA policy during the Depression hurt the average physician struggling to keep their practice afloat. Rejecting Democratic calls to subsidize demand, that is, pay people's medical bills, as un-American, the group instead put a squeeze on supply. AMA President Walter Baring's call for half of the medical schools in the country to be shut down was never realized. But between 1934 and 1940, medical schools sharply reversed years of rising enrollments. In his account of the policy, Paul Starr notes that it reduced the number of medical personnel available for the war and worsened a critical shortage of doctors in rural parts of the country. When Roosevelt made the decision to exclude health care from the Social Security Act of 1935, he mollified health care hawks on the administration's Committee on Economic Security by promising to push for government insurance in the near future. In the meantime, the New Dealers landed at least one body blow in return. In August 1938, Thurman Arnold opened a grand jury investigation into the group's attempted sabotage of a voluntary insurance pool organized by federal employees. Evidence gathered by the FBI showed the AMA had attempted to deny pool members access to local hospitals and threatened member physicians who accepted payments from the pool with expulsion and censure. The group's leadership lambasted Arnold in the press for promoting socialized medicine and perverting the antitrust laws. In 1943, the Supreme Court issued a unanimous decision upholding the Justice Department's fines against the AMA and an affiliated D.C. medical society. As it waged an unsuccessful appeal of the Supreme Court ruling, the AMA opened its first office in the Capitol. It was home to a new body called the Council on Medical Services and Public Relations, created to lead the counteroffensive against Roosevelt's expected second push to add government insurance to an expansion of the Social Security Act. From its suite downtown, the AMA Council coordinated with the National Physicians Committee, a freshly established doctors group funded by the AMA's old friend turned invigorating ally in the fight against activist government, the pharmaceutical industry. The AMA and the drug companies were prepared when Roosevelt listed health insurance in the Second Bill of Rights. He announced in his State of the Union address on January 11, 1944. The inclusion took many Democrats by surprise. Less than a year before, the president was still resisting pressure from the left to take on the AMA, telling one Democratic senator, "We can't go up against the state medical societies, we just can't do it." After Roosevelt's death in April 1945, the job of resisting that pressure fell to Harry Truman, who in September of that year announced his support for a second Bill of Rights that included the right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. 2 months later, Truman sent a long message to the 79th Congress in its final weeks of Democratic control. "The time has arrived for action," said Truman. "The benefits of modern medical science have not been enjoyed by our citizens with any degree of equality, nor will they be in the future unless government is bold enough to do something about it." Truman emphasized that his proposal was not socialized medicine. Doctors and patients would still have freedom of choice, with the all-important difference that patients getting the services they need would not depend on how much they can afford to pay at the time. Polls showed the plan had overwhelming support. Chipping at that support would not be any easier than weakening support for other popular social programs of the New Deal. But the health care plan had not yet been passed, and the first winds of post-war anti-communism were blowing in the direction of the AMA and its old friend, the drug industry. After retaking Congress in 1946, Republicans began parroting AMA scripts that described government insurance as, in the words of Ohio Senator Robert Taft, the most socialistic measure this Congress has ever had before it. A Republican House subcommittee, meanwhile, launched an investigation of Truman's promotion of health insurance to determine if known communists and fellow travelers within federal agencies are at work diligently with federal funds in furtherance of the Moscow party line. This was something more than the AMA resistance foreseen by Roosevelt. By fanning the first flickers of anti-communist hysteria, Truman had played Sorcerer's Apprentice to the politics that allowed the opposition to destroy the popular Roosevelt policy he'd adopted as his own. When Truman won re-election in 1948, the AMA added fresh coal to its red-baiting engine. Collecting an additional $25 in annual dues from membership, it set in motion the costliest lobbying and public relations campaign in the country's history. The AMA's $1.5 million effort, writes Paul Starr, used pamphlets, the press, public speakers, and private contacts to stress that voluntarism was the American way and to persuade private organizations, 1,829 of them, according to its count, to endorse the AMA position. Would socialized medicine lead to socialization of other phases of American life? That's one pamphlet. And it answered, Lenin thought so. He declared, socialized medicine is the keystone to the arch of the socialist state. The Library of Congress could not locate this quotation in Lenin's writings. As anti-communist sentiment rose in the late 40s, national health insurance became vanishingly improbable. An AMA-led alliance that included the drug companies and the Chamber of Commerce accomplished more than just block national health insurance. By stripping the 1950 Social Security Act of an amendment to expand coverage to include people who had become totally disabled before reaching retirement age, it also defeated the first attempt to pass national disability insurance. By then, the AMA was spending more than $2 million annually to educate Americans about the evils of national social and medical insurance. Drug industry money funded many of the ad buys that saturated print and radio with corporate propaganda cloaked in the cultural authority of the family doctor. The post-ethical AMA pharmaceutical alliance developed into the 1950s as patent reform displaced government insurance as their most pressing menace. Though medicine was not directly threatened by patent reform, its relationship with the drug industry had become symbiotic. They increasingly shared the financial spoils of monopoly, and these spoils were the foundation of their political power. After the Kefauver hearings ended, with patents secure, the alliance shifted again, this time back to the insurance front, where Democrats were pushing for programs to insure the poor and elderly, soon to be known as Medicaid and Medicare. Organized medicine received large contributions from pharmaceutical firms to fight health insurance, in addition to the revenues from pharmaceutical advertising and AMA journals, writes Starr. The doctors received the support in part because of the strategic location they held in the marketing of drugs. Their gatekeeping function allowed them to collect a toll for use in political agitation. Compared to the drug companies, the AMA was slow to revise its ethical codes on patents. While the major pharmaceutical associations had updated their charters with conditional benedictions of intellectual property by World War II, the AMA did not overhaul its principles of medical ethics until 1955. Henceforth, its member physicians could patent and profit from their medical inventions, so long, the new code stipulated, as research and access were not impacted. But these were empty words. The moral and political tensions within organized medicine had been resolved in the direction of business and profit, of mammon and dishonor, as Nathan Smith Davis, one of the AMA's founders and twice its president, once put it. Edward Hyde had consumed Dr. Henry Jekyll. And yet there were holdouts. Within academic medicine and even industry research, influential pockets of refuseniks clung to the old ways. These dead-enders expressed their concerns privately to university officials and publicly in the press and in Senate hearings, where they lambasted the new order of industry consulting, academic patent profiteering, and deepening medical journal dependence on ads from medically dubious prescription drug monopolies. What made them dangerous wasn't their numbers, but their status. They were medical school deans, senior faculty, and national laboratory directors. They made eloquent testimonies on Capitol Hill that used the old ethical language to attack patents and advocate for regulation and government health care. The academic prigs, these therapeutic nihilists, are our most severe critics and must not be ignored. An executive with Wyeth Laboratories told a November 1964 gathering of the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association. In her book, Pills, Power, and Policy, Dominic Tubble recounts the influential classification of the post-war establishment by a Wyeth executive named Daniel Shaw. The largest group of academic physicians and researchers consisted of what Shaw called friendly neutrals that could easily be molded into one of our most prized assets. A majority of mid-level and even senior medical researchers he also considered unthreatening and winnable, being either pro-industry or indifferent to politics. Only the last and smallest group, the academic prigs, worried Shaw. If they could not be co-opted, they would have to be made irrelevant. The prigs represented the old order. Shaw was the archetype of the new. His employer, Wyeth Laboratories, began its history as a member of the Philadelphia establishment during the mid-19th century crown and height of ethical drug manufacture. A century later, it was a boundary-smashing pace-setter, and the Wyeth detail man, the representative figure of a monopoly-based industry. The Wyeth man was known by his sharp suits, generous expense account, and a leather satchel bag filled with freebie samples of the company's best-selling drug, a shield-shaped pill called Equinil. The world's first tranquilizer and the engine of Wyeth's post-war growth came from an unlikely source, a committed socialist steeped in the idealism and traditions of the European University. A German-speaking Czech Jewish immigrant, Frank Berger, arrived in the United States after the war faithful to the idea that medical research should benefit and belong to all. In an interview with historian Andrea Tone, he described fleeing Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia in 1938 and settling in Britain, where he made key contributions to the transatlantic penicillin project, refining and extending the shelf life of mold samples he'd received from Alexander Fleming. Just as Fleming discovered the antimicrobial properties of penicillin with a chance observation of a pile of unwashed petri dishes, Berger's research produced a serendipitous stumble of his own. While investigating penicillin preservatives, he noticed that one of his candidate compounds appeared to produce an abnormally relaxed state in lab mice. Berger isolated the compound, mifepristone, and after the war it was developed as a treatment for muscle control conditions such as Parkinson's. In line with his personal code of ethics, he published his research quickly so that no commercial exploitation may deprive any human being of its benefits. After settling in the United States after the war, Berger turned down multiple offers to consult for drug companies and accepted a research job at the University of Rochester. Only after he was rejected for a life insurance policy, due to high blood pressure, did he revisit the company offers. The Communist Party takeover of Czechoslovakia hadn't changed his broadly socialist politics, but it did cost him his savings and property. In 1949, he doubled his former university salary by accepting a job as president and medical director of Wallace Laboratories, the new research division of a little-known company called Carter Products. In the 1870s, the firm had been a leading seller of patent medicines, its star product, a laxative called Carter's Little Liver Pills. Wake up your liver bile. Its owners wanted to replicate this success in the new century, and the fastest way to do that was to get their hands on a patented blockbuster prescription drug. Ensconced in Wallace Laboratories' well-supplied New Jersey Research Center, Berger returned to his wartime experiments with nerve relaxants and sedatives. Within 2 years, he developed a molecule that had effects similar to his earlier discovery, mifepristone, but lasted longer and carried less debilitating side effects. Berger named it metrobamate and saw its effects in high-minded terms. He regarded excessive anxiety as an impediment to clear thought and reason, the hallmarks of enlightenment and progress, writes Andrea Tone in her History of Tranquilizers, The Age of Anxiety. It was both a risky and auspicious moment to introduce a novel sedative. In 1951, the government brought a hammer down on the overprescription of barbiturates, the first synthetic. Berger believed metrobamate was safer and less prone to abuse than barbiturates, but its main effect, rapidly depressing the central nervous system, was strikingly similar. Introduced under patent to the U.S. market by German firms in the early 1900s, the first barbiturates were sold under a number of trademarks that suggested their use as sleeping aids. Secanol, Luminol, Nembutal. All were perennial blockbusters. By the late 1930s, Americans were consuming more than a billion barbiturates annually. Industry materials described the drugs as modern descendants of opiates and chlorohydrates, the shotgun sleeping aids of the 19th and early 20th centuries. The marketing did not mention barbiturates' rapid production of tolerance, high rates of addiction, and overdose risk. Barbiturates' alleged link to juvenile crime and an overdose epidemic led Congress in 1951 to pass a bill regulating what editorialists and reformers called the devil's capsules. Henceforth, barbiturates would be sold only with a doctor's order, and they became the first drug class ever required by law to display the phrase prescription only on its packaging. At a 3-day meeting of drug makers held that year at the Biltmore Hotel, the lead lawyer of the proprietary association called the labeling requirement a handmaiden of socialized medicine that jeopardizes the traditional right of self-medication and choice of remedies. The National Association of Retail Druggists, perhaps remembering the acetanilide deaths of the aspirin wars, backed the reforms. The reputation of barbiturates was at its lowest point when Berger prepared the first human trials of what he believed to be a safer, less addictive, less toxic sedative. After seeing his data, regulators agreed. When meprobamate was approved for sale by the FDA in 1955, Carter Products turned its attention to finding a partner to license and produce what it called a tranquilizer. Paul Johnson, the future founder of Johnson Pharmaceuticals, coined the word over dinner with Berger. The firm conducted this search in what should have been a receptive and hungry market. Between 1929 and 1939, the prescription drug business grew a thousandfold, and by 1949 accounted for more than half the entire drug market. But by the early 1950s, profit rates had begun to slow. Golden Goose patents were expiring, and generic competition was on the rise. To compensate, drug companies pumped money into marketing budgets that swelled the ranks of detail men, tasked with maintaining brand awareness. They also prowled the research landscape for the next patentable prescription blockbuster. Strangely, the big firms all gave meprobamate a look and passed. There was no precedent for prescription-only anti-anxiety medicine, no history of outpatient psychiatry at all. Wyeth Laboratories alone saw the potential. Among the major companies based in Philadelphia, Wyeth was always ahead of the post-ethical curve. The rise of detail men was industry-wide. Between 1929 and 1959, the nation's drug sales force grew from 2 to 15,000, but Wyeth blazed the trail. By 1950, its sales force of nearly 1,000 had a first-in-class reputation. Groomed to perfection, writes Tone, the Wyeth detail man underwent an intensive 18-month training program and upheld an industry-wide code of style and comportment. Together with middle and upper-rank Wyeth executives, they showered physicians with a largesse akin to Roman splendor, according to one contemporary. Wyeth's proposal to Carter Products reflected the firm's confidence in meprobamate. It offered to pay twice the production cost of the drug, plus 5% royalties, in exchange for an exclusive license to market the drug to doctors under an exclusive trademark. Carter would retain title and the right to sell meprobamate on the consumer market under a different trademark. Both Wyeth's version of the drug, Equinil, and Carter's, Milltown, were runaway successes. Within a year of its 1955 release, Milltown had become not just a household name but a cultural totem. Associated with Hollywood glamour, it received unpaid celebrity endorsements from Milton Berle, Sugar Ray Robinson, and Aldous Huxley. After hearing reports that Salvador Dali was a devotee, Carter commissioned the surrealist painter to create a Milltown-themed installation for the 1958 meeting of the American Medical Association. Wyeth was also printing money and struggling to keep up with orders from family physicians prescribing Equinil as an all-purpose treatment for depression, anxiety, insomnia, alcoholism, and agitation. The birth of popular psychopharmacology added sinew to what Dominic Tubble calls the industry's Cold War alliances with practicing and academic medicine. The displacement of psychiatrists brought newly empowered family doctors closer to the drug companies, where they could be cultivated as the industry's most prized assets, as Wyeth's Daniel Shaw put it. At the same time, the sudden appearance of prescription drug ads in medical journals created a dependency on the companies that rivaled Americans' developing reliance on the drugs themselves. A typical full-page, full-color Wyeth ad from the period touted three different forms of Equinil tablets, described as a normotropic drug for nearly every patient under stress. The ad drew attention to the newest of the three designs, a yellow 400-milligram tablet that tranquilizer-conscious patients will not recognize. Another touted acceptably flavored liquid Equinil as the perfect solution for children and the aged in anxiety and tension states. The smash success of the tranquilizer created an instant scramble for the next mood-altering blockbuster. Within a year of Miltown's release, drug companies had redirected their focus to developing or scouting the next Miltown. In a sedative market, Hoffman LaRoche trotted into the winner's circle in 1960 with the first benzodiazepine, Librium, followed in 1963 by a little blue pill called Valium. Stronger and with a faster onset than tranquilizers, Valium also mixed better with the martini. The unofficial emblem of Cold War suburban anxiety, it was the country's best-selling drug between 1968 and 1982. Downers had competition in the billion-dollar anxiety management market, amphetamines. SKF patented the first pharmaceutical speed in the U.S. market, amphetamine sulfate in 1937, and had retained first-mover advantage after the war. In 1947, the company rolled out Benzedrine and Dexedrine. In 1956, the Swiss firm Ciba struck gold in the United States by patenting methylphenidate, an amphetamine derivative trademarked as Ritalin and positionally marketed as a happy medium in psychomotor stimulation. The company won its place in a crowded speed market with a positional marketing campaign touting a happy medium in psychomotor stimulation. The amphetamine market was another showcase for the symbiotic partnership between industry and medicine. Advertising amphetamine as a harmless weight loss treatment for women required AMA approval, which was granted, resulting in a flood of advertising buys in medical journals that pushed amphetamine sales through the roof. These profits, in turn, funded more and bigger ad buys, as well as juicier perks for prescribing doctors doled out by armies of detail men who were hired with the profits of the prescription drugs being advertised so heavily in the journals and doctors' offices. Around and around it went, creating greater profits and an ever tighter union of interests and forces. This cycle required all sides to dispense with the pretenses that defined the transitional phase of ethical patenting during the first half of the century. This could be seen in the case of SKF's patent on Dexedrine. As the expiration of its valuable monopoly loomed, the company patented one of the most profitable Me Too drugs of all time, Dexamil, a prescription combination of Dexedrine and the barbiturate Amitol. The patent and associated marketing campaign broke all the old rules of ethical patenting, beginning with its complete lack of molecular novelty. But it was a winner that dominated the pharmaceutical speed market well into the 1960s. Everybody benefited and few complained. The industry was not just printing money, it was spreading it around. In January 1960, a bottle of Miltown tablets cost $3.25 in the United States versus 69 cents in Germany. The only entity strong enough to infringe on the Carter-Wyeth monopoly was the United States itself, which is to say the government that granted the patent and protected it in its courts. Occasionally, the industry would be reminded of this simple fact about intellectual property claims, that they exist at the pleasure of a sovereign and on the sovereign's terms, as when the Pentagon imported generic meprobamate from Sweden in defiance of the Carter patent in 1961. At the time, the military was also imploring off-label tetracycline, Pfizer's best-selling patented antibiotic. On October 12, 1963, the nation's pharmaceutical executives awoke to disturbing news. Included in that morning's edition of the Federal Register was a four-page presidential memorandum directed to the heads of all executive departments and agencies. Hereafter, the proclamation read, the government shall normally acquire or reserve the right to acquire the principal or exclusive rights to any inventions made in the course of or under the contract. John F. Kennedy, it seemed, had been sympathetic to the Kilgore-Kefauver position on public science and patents after all. The executive order issued just weeks before Kennedy's assassination placed the federal research complex under a regime that reflected New Deal ideas about the importance of keeping democratic control of public knowledge and diffusing it for broad social benefit. The attempt to overturn the order policy would shape the drug industry's lobbying and policy agendas for the next two decades. Under the terms of the Kennedy Memorandum, private contractors could, in rare instances, be granted exclusive rights on federally funded inventions. But such cases were to be the exception, and only when such a course was deemed most likely to serve the public interest. This applied across agencies, but the memo expressly called out research contracts connected to exploration into fields which directly concern the public health or public welfare. All exceptions to the general policy, meanwhile, would be conditional on contractors fulfilling their obligation to serve the public interest. If the contractor made no progress toward the practical application of the invention within 3 years of being granted a monopoly, or if it failed to make it available to licensees on reasonable terms, the agency heads were instructed to assert their power and license the invention on a royalty-free, non-exclusive basis. The memorandum specified this power be applied most liberally when needed to fulfill a health need. The memorandum cast a global eye, using a definition of the public interest that was both international and self-interested. Like Truman's support for Nehru's state penicillin project and Eisenhower's offer to help the Soviets produce the Salk vaccine, Kennedy understood U.S. medicine as a priceless instrument of soft power on the world stage. "The government must have control," Kennedy wrote, "over the sharing of the benefits of government-financed research and development with foreign countries to a degree consistent with our international programs and with the objectives of U.S. foreign policy." While paying lip service to the role of incentives to draw forth private initiatives, it hewed more closely in spirit and letter to the strict policy advocated by the New Dealers than the loose ad hoc policy supported by industry. The order remained in force following Kennedy's assassination in Dallas on November 22nd. It was maintained with special rigor by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, which had been on similarly strict track since its founding in 1953. Following the Kennedy policy, the agency took an even stricter line. The IPA program, the wiggle room mechanism established under Eisenhower to allow contractors in special cases to claim patents, was all but canceled. In the 5 years following Kennedy's memorandum, the agency turned down 34 out of 34 contractor patent claims on publicly funded inventions. But the number of contractors working with HEW was abnormally low during the mid-1960s. This is because displeased drug companies had responded to the Kennedy order by making good on a threat they'd been throwing around since the Kilgore hearings. It was a threat that was hard to square with their tireless claims of selfless patriotism. They announced a boycott of the United States government. Screening programs involved testing long series of candidate molecules for a particular response. When NIH-funded labs screen the products of their research, they often pay outside contractors for the job. Sometimes the desired response is discovered. In other cases, molecules are found to have unintended applications that are pleasant surprises. The history of drugs is full of accidental discoveries resulting from screening candidates organized by a long series of numbers. Albert Hofmann discovered LSD-25 through a chance mishandling of the 25th molecule in a series of experimental treatments for uterine bleeding during childbirth. In the first months of COVID-19, it was a government screening of Gilead's molecular vault that led NIH scientists to flag GS-5734, later named Remdesivir and trademarked as Veklury, as a possible therapy for COVID-19. The post-war years witnessed a growing sophistication in molecular chemistry that resulted in greater opportunities for this kind of collaboration. The NIH conducted research and hired drug companies to help classify and identify promising molecules. Sometimes this work resulted in contractors claiming title on research in hopes of developing a successful commercial product and monopolizing its market. The Kennedy patent policy greatly reduced the scope for these claims. The companies were also concerned about the policy's implication for what it called contamination. If a contractor integrated an element of publicly funded research into an in-house project, the fusion would produce a hybrid product that the companies feared could be the subject of an ownership claim by the Surgeon General. Given that nearly every medical invention of the past 100 years has relied on some measure of public science, the industry's fear of a public interest standard being applied to contaminated or related inventions was rational. But their response was not, given the broad license they had to use public science and their high success rate in winning patents based on even the most dubious claims of novelty. The companies refused to play by the rules of the Kennedy policy. Following the release of the 1962 memorandum, they stopped signing screening contracts that reflected the new restrictions on contractor patent claims. A 1968 report commissioned by the Senate Subcommittee on Patents, Trademarks, and Copyrights described the results. The immediate effect of the drug firm's refusal to sign the amended patent agreement was their almost complete withdrawal from screening compounds resulting from NIH research, having to do without the drug firm's screening services, which in their total range include specific screening, extensive test results, and concomitant development work, means to the academic investigator that the work on his compound that is necessary for ultimate utilization is cut off, in most cases, at the development stage. The shock of realizing its dependence on a fickle and selfish industry could have led the U.S. government to expand its purview in the development of medicines, from basic science to trials. This was, in fact, the policy being pursued around the world, from Sweden to India. The United States did not follow this path, and the stalemate ended on the industry's terms. In 1969, Richard Nixon's secretary of HEW, Robert Finch, reversed the agency's suspension of the IPA exception, and the drug companies resumed screenings and other forms of collaboration. They had not spent the intervening 7 years waiting idly for a Republican president. In 1964, the pharmaceutical and chemical industries came together to lobby for reversing the Kennedy policy in HEW and every other government agency. The industry's strongest ally in Congress was conservative Arkansas Democrat John McClellan, chair of the Senate Subcommittee on Patents, Trademarks, and Copyrights. McClellan drafted a bill closely reflecting the agenda of the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association in its belief that Kennedy's approach to public health was perfectly backward. When the purpose of a contract is to explore the fields of public health, welfare, or safety, stated the group, we think it is even more important, rather than less important, to encourage the perfection and marketing of the inventions. When McClellan's bill stalled in the House, the industry had 5 years before Nixon's election to think about what a truly pro-industry patent policy might look like. Such a policy would be partially realized in the waning days of the Carter administration, before being fashioned into the stuff of drug industry dreams under Ronald Reagan. The midwives of this policy shift would perform burial rites over the Kennedy policy and the broader New Deal vision for public science. They would do so with a swagger born of a victory more momentous than the rollback of any law or decades-old executive order. They would do so as emissaries fulfilling an audacious intellectual project with roots deeper than the Kennedy policy and the New Deal itself. This project of ideas sought to reverse and repeal the legacy of mid-century liberalism the hard way, by rewriting history and rewiring the nation's most deeply held conceptions about democracy, monopoly, antitrust, and corporate power. It pursued this reversal under the claimed authority of a hybrid science, unveiled in the inaugural 1958 issue of the Journal of Law and Economics. Published out of the University of Chicago, the journal advocated ideas considered queer for their time, but it did so comfortably on the dime of two generous and well-fixed private backers. One was the Lilly family drug fortune.